This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Denise Mark Comich. I'm the curator at MassMoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts. And put together this little exhibition, this little book here, called Explode Every Day, An Inquiry into the Phenomenon of Wonder. And I want to start by thanking Sina and Cabinet for hosting this event here. And, you know, basically we're going to have a conversation about wonder, and I've got two great companions in this. Lawrence Weschler, amazing writer of books that I'm sure you've all read, Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees, Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders, Steve Holmes, who is the curator of the Carton Collection, and also a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. They've both contributed to this book, and I think Ren wants to start us off.
Yeah. I usually like to start things like this off with the afternoon prayer, and I have two of them today because I didn't know which one to use, but since we're talking about wonder, I figured we definitely need to have a baseball poem. Wonder of Wonders, Chicago Cubs versus Cleveland. So this is a poem by Robert Francis, who was a wonderful Greek poet in the 50s. And he did a poem about each position in the field. And this is his poem called Pitcher. His art is eccentricity. His aim, how not to hit the mark he seems to aim at. His passion, how to avoid the obvious. His technique, how to vary the avoidance. The others throw to be comprehended. He throws to be a little bit misunderstood. Yet not too much, not errant wild, but every seeming aberration will. Not to be yet still to communicate. Waiting the batter understand too late. And then the other one I was going to use was on the beat from Thomas Great Undertaker. And this is just to set up the dynamic of science and art. And this is a poem by Euclid, you know, Euclid the geometer. What sort of warning was Euclid having when he first considered parallel lines? Or that business about things equal to the same thing or equal to each other? Who's still what the day has in it? This morning, Bert took it into his mind to make a longbow out of cottage orange and went on eBay to find the cow horns from which to fashion the tips of the thing. You better have something to pass the time, he says, stirring his coffee. And Murray is carving a model trunk from a block of wood that he found downstairs. Which leaned away, he thinks, of the years he drove between Detroit and Buffalo delivering parts for General Motors. Might he have nursed theorems on lines and dots, or the properties of triangles, or the congruence of adjacent angles? Or clearing customs at Niagara Falls, arrived at some insight on holes and parts, or an axiom involving radii and the making of circles? How distance from a center point can be both increased endlessly and endlessly split? A mystery whereby the local and the global share the same vexations in geometry. Possibly wisdom or God comes into it, who breathed the common notion of coincidence into the brain of that Alexandrian over breakfast 23 centuries back, who glimpsed for a moment that morning the sense it all made. Life, killing time, the elements, the dots and lines and angles of connection, an egg's shell opened with a spoon, the sun's connivance with the moon's decline. Sophia, the maidservant, pouring juice. Everything coinciding. The art of memory, her fine parabolas, the bend of a bow, the curve of the earth, the turn of the road.
That's one of my favorite prayers to start a panel that I've ever been witness to. Thank you, Ren. So just to give people a little bit of background, this exhibition and this book is a project that I've been working on for about 5 years. And I will say it started by wondering about wonder. I think wonder is something that we all have experiences with. It's all something that is very personal. One person's wonder is another person's boredom. And I thought, you know, what would it mean to make an exhibition about something that is ineffable? So that's essentially what I set out to do. And one of the things in putting this book together is I wanted it to be a guidebook, something that would transcend just the exhibition, that would be a book of thinking about these ideas. One of the tricky things about wonder is that you can't create it for other people. You can't say, this book will make you feel wonder. But you can talk about those conditions and talk about those, you know, the different things that make that happen. So I thought it would be nice to start off. So in the book, I have a number of writers from various disciplines who wrote about science, who wrote about humanity, religion, all of the above. But one of the things I did in the book was I asked each of the artists a series of questions. And I didn't ask that of any of the writers. So I want to take the opportunity now to ask two of my co-authors some of those questions. So the first question is, what is your definition of wonder? Should I start with mine, or do you want to start with yours?
Show me yours first.
I'll show you mine if you show me yours. Okay. I have come to trying to find a concise definition of wonder, which for me is the gap between knowing and not knowing.
For me, I understand the word wonder to refer to those moments of knowing something without knowing how it is you know it, or without being able to argue that you know it. You simply do.
We've talked about the... I generally describe the experience of wonder as these pillow of air moments, where you suddenly find yourself with a pillow of air lodged in your mouth, and you notice that you haven't breathed for 10 seconds. And around the end of the 10 seconds, you realize you've been in the state of wonder. Part of when you're in the state of wonder, you don't know you're in the state of wonder. It's always a past tense experience, it seems to me. But there is this kind of lodged, this physically lodged pillow of air.
And it's interesting that, Steve, you were talking about knowledge, and that was a little bit in my definition, too. And, you know, for you, Ren, this lapse of knowing. That I think it's interesting how often wonder and knowledge get talked about together, but it really is about this not knowing. And, you know...
Well, it's about knowing using a different... this is where it starts to feel a little bit soft, but... What interests me about wonder, let me back up one more step. The term aesthetic experience and the term religious experience both come into usage within the same 10-year period of Romanticism. The first time those terms are used, one is post-Kant, and really comes out of work by Friedrich Schleiermacher to explain how it is we know certain things to be true, even though we can't use reason to get to them. And so for Kant, that was the sublime. And you can see where we're going. It was a sublime Caspar David Friedrich and the landscape and knowing oneself as the subject. What happens for me and what becomes a challenge for me is that 300 years later, 200-300 years later, we forget that that was in reaction to a period that was obsessed with science, rationale, the rational and the data. And so, when we talk about knowing and how we know something now, that's almost always dominated, I think, or there's a presumption of the privilege of data as opposed to pure, undifferentiated, inexpressible experience. So it's that back and forth between what you experience and knowing that there's cognition happening in that experience versus what you come to understand through, you know, your basic application of reason and rationale. What I can do is connect that back as a student of religion and theology, one of the most profoundly moving areas of study that I was privileged to have was to take an astronomy course, which was by far the more exhilarating course I ever took as an undergraduate, or I still remember it.
And why do you think that was? Do you think it was because of just that? I mean, when I think about astronomy and I think of the sciences, I think about that kind of vast unknown.
Well, what's interesting is that what I become aware of is I'm a subject thinking about the universe, but the universe couldn't give a shit that I'm here. And it's that feeling of, you know, we talk about this as being, you know, insignificant, and we use poetry to describe it, and sometimes we get embarrassed because it starts to feel a little bit touchy-feely, the language you use. But I think, you know, the more you talk with scientists and the deeper into the real hard stuff, also the more ineffable it starts to become. And so as a subject, the ability to actually understand the insignificance of myself, even as I'm experiencing that insignificance, becomes this sort of frisson of wonder.
Mm-hmm. But the universe, in a certain sense, doesn't even exist without, as an object of contemplation, without a contemplating, it's in a kind of autistic interiority, unless there's that little tiny thing of you is contemplating it, or our strong person. One thing I was going to say, though, is that period of science that precedes the post-Kant is preceded itself by a great age of wonder,
high middle ages,
which, well, or even a little bit later, basically, from roughly 1490 to Descartes, basically. Some of the great stuff there is the way in which there's suddenly this debauch that everybody has to have wonder habits, and everybody's interested in weirdest things they can find, and you're going to be told that you're supposed to have one of these things for your house. And this is all, it's basically the 16th century into the early 17th century, and it arises essentially from the discovery of America, from all this completely bizarre stuff that's coming in over the transom. Moose antlers, you know, unicorn horns, which were seen, you know, wall horns. And weird parrot feathers and all this kind of stuff. It was just blowing Europe's mind. And suddenly there was this incredible taste for, bedazzlement by wonder. And it was precisely when this began to overflow into kind of shysterism and phoniness and that Descartes basically is saying, you know, is slapping the pillow of air out of your mouth. You know, get serious. Let's have some standards, and it is in response to that debauch and wonder that you get that incredible period of science, which in turn does the Kant coming at the end, and some of those romantics their response to that too.
Because that time was also, you know, like you said, Descartes slapping you. It was like an undoing of wonder.
Well, yeah.
In many ways, because I think. And I think that's also where it becomes really interesting to think about wonder and curiosity.
Well, wonder becomes suspect.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And like, but also thinking back to that notion of knowledge and looking and, you know, trying to suss out that difference between wonder and curiosity. And, you know, curiosity being this sort of quest for knowledge and wonder being this different state. And I think a lot of what was happening there with the wonder cameras that they were turning into like a curiosity, but they were also turning into that kind of madness of have to have it. And when you when everybody has it, it's not a wonder anymore.
Well, and also that being possessed by your possessions.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Shakespeare is very much into this discourse at the end. I mean, Prospero, all this stuff. There's all kinds of stuff in Shakespeare about fraudulent wonder cabinet people and so forth. But there's a social dimension to that too. I mean, the Wunderkammern, and you know, were really a product of people with money. large estates, people with money, and the notion of collecting. If we collect all of this information, we become sort of, we can begin to make statements about how the world is based on huge amounts of specimens of various kinds, whether it's shells or feathers or whatever. But that's happening. Against a social and political backdrop where there is a contest for authority and knowledge with the church. So access to capital means exploration, means bringing back all this stuff. And in the acquisition of the stuff, you come to some clearer understanding of how things actually are. It's interesting you bring up Descartes, but you know, if I think about moments of sort of wonder or sort of disembodiment of my own mind, I remember very clearly for the first time holding a copy of, happened to have been able, been lucky enough to hold copies of all of Descartes' first editions in very early collation, which means these are the very first printings off the press of the Cogito, which is in Meditation. Which one is it in? Anybody? Meditations? Yeah. Thanks. So to open the page and you'll pulse and be able to put my finger, and we're doing that. I think therefore I am, just to be able to put my finger on those words as they exist on paper in the first collation, where those words don't know yet what it is they will unleash. So what does it even mean to just physically have that in your hands and to feel that tingle? That's cognition. It's a cognition that we can't access through language. It doesn't mean it's not true. It doesn't mean it's not rigorous. It doesn't mean it's not demanding or occasionally embarrassing. It's something that, in many cases, we actually try and push back against. Which is great for psychotherapists.
It's interesting, by the way, about that moment. I once wrote a piece about Rembrandt's anatomy lesson. And one of the things that's fascinating all the way is alchemy becoming chemistry, astrology becoming astronomy, all kinds of weird collections of odd fetuses and so forth gradually becoming anatomy. And in the anatomy lesson, you have this remarkable situation where this kind of ghoulish, morbid anatomy, to coin a phrase, anatomy is entertainment, anatomy is collecting, and so forth, is slowly becoming science, as we understand it today. And what's fascinating when you look at the anatomy lesson is that, if you remember it in your head, there's the professor, Tulp, is standing over the corpse. He's the one with the cape over him. The corpse, incidentally, we now know, or we found out, was a prisoner who had been hung for stealing a plunk. That's what he'd been hung for. It's winter. In Leiden, they did it all year round, but in Amsterdam, they only did it once a year. And it's a theater. There's a people audience like you, and probably would have been a slanted audience. I mean, it would have gone uphill so that you could have all looked out. And in the painting, three of the people are looking absolutely pillow of air, thunderstruck, and you can see the pillow of air when you go back home. And if you think it in your mind, I think most of you will think that they're looking at the corpse, or you know, and so forth. They're not looking at the corpse. They're looking at the professor's hand. He is holding a knife, and he's pointing here at these muscles here in the arm, and he's going like this. And the people over here who are looking at him are just going, like they've never seen anything so amazing in their life. And when you stop and think about it, don't do that right now. That is like the most amazing thing that you could do. That it's about vision and hands, which is to say, it's about painting. And another way, they're all looking at Rembrandt's hand as he paints the hand. But the other three are looking out into the audience, are looking out at Rembrandt, you could say. I mean, keep in mind, this is a painting that takes 6 months to paint, so it's different every day. This is a fiction, completely. It's a fiction that Rembrandt is inventing. It's the photograph.
but they are all looking out at us, or at, and arguably, and Semmel makes this point, that the most fascinating thing is that they're looking at Descartes. Because in all likelihood, Descartes was in that audience. Descartes was in exile in Amsterdam at that moment. And he was very interested in that. I mean, he would have certainly been there. And then when he gets to the meditation 6 years later, he does all this stuff about the robotics, you know, the hands of the machine. It's all that stuff is happening from that day. And you happen to have both Rembrandt and Descartes in the same audience, basically at the moment that science is being invented.
But, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, when I was working on this, going back to reading Descartes, and, you know, he had these whole chapters on the passions of the soul, on swooning and fainting, but he's very measured when it comes to wonder. It is the first passion. It is the thing that births all the other passions, but he warns you constantly, warns you off of it. And I think it's interesting that, you know, two of the words that you brought up just a minute ago were like the tingle, but also embarrassment. And one of the things as I was working on the show is I realized this is about emotion, which is a thing that the art world is often embarrassed by. But I think something that is inherent to one, it's a letting go. And why? I wonder why we're so.
It's terrifying. And the mystics of the High Middle Ages, Meister Eifert, who's these people, mystical experiences, again, you sort of soften what that means now, or you've conflated that with some notion of a very light emotional response to something. But the mystical experiences of, you know, the real hard-ass mystics is a terrifying, terrifying experience, because it's a moment of admitting that your faculties of reason or comprehension can't account for what it is that's going on, and yet what's going on is something that's going to have a profound impact on you, on culture, whatever. But, you know, as we were talking the first 10 minutes of the conversation, every time I heard the word wonder, you could substitute the word art or substitute the word beauty and then run that through again. We're embarrassed by notions of beauty at the moment. The art world has been on and off. Some studio visits show more beauty than others, from my point of view. But I remember a few years ago getting into a lot of trouble. I'll do it again now, for the sake of a conversation. There's a lot of work that I see that is really complex, very discursive, incredibly smart, but lacks that thing that I think many of us all understand what I mean when I say that thing, that art thing. There's something there that's not accountable under any of the other sort of art historical or critical apparatus you can apply to it. In other words, it moves you. And as a curator of contemporary art, you're not supposed to have those experiences. If you are, you keep it to yourself.
Or you
put it in a book. Or what you do is you mention them, but you slide them in with language having to do with engagement of discursive practices in the expanded field. Right? And if you can get out of Dodge, having done a show, posted a curator statement, published something, and not had your director or your colleagues go apeshit on you, then you feel really lucky. But this is the exact same experience, I would argue, that Schleiermacher, Novalis, Friedrich, other romantics have had, and you can set the clock back again and you'll see those exact same moments of embarrassment and tension in the High Middle Ages. And, you know, we get into this really voluptuous period of the Renaissance where there's enough money going around that everybody can feel, you know, be happy, fat and stupid. But again, when that cycle, that historical cycle, hits its crisis, we come back to that same thing. Nobody wants to say it out loud. But for me, I'll just say, when I'm talking with people and I need to really put out there where I stand on something, it tends to go like this. If I can tell you what this piece of art means, for me, I'm not interested, it's not art. Which isn't to say it's not interesting or important, but for me, very specifically, I need to have something there that I can't account for. Otherwise, it's not. I'm just saying what my needs are.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I get them, and it doesn't mean that they're rational.
But I think it's interesting, you know, as I was writing this, I had these moments where I would, you know, call up a friend or say, you know, I feel like I have to write about love. I feel like I have to write about heart and emotion in this. It's such an emotional topic. And, you know, I was like, but I feel like I'm not supposed to, but I'm going to do it anyway because it has to be done. It's that thing of, like, you can't pin it down. And to me, that makes it more important to talk about. And I remember early on somebody saying, well, this is an impossible exhibition. And I said, well, that makes me want to do it more. But it's also interesting because I think going back and what gave me the push to be able to write from that place was reading people like Descartes. Because even, you know, at their time, they were still, we can look at it now and say, oh, well, he was warning us, he was measured, but it's still so much more like flowing than the kind of writing you get now that it's like, you know, we can write from that place of the emotional. It doesn't always have to be the post-discursive blah-de-blah.
You were thinking about the terror in wonder, or in mysticism, let's say. And that brings us back to Nicholas of Cusa, where we had this conversation. And he has this wonderful, wonderful metaphor at one point. First of all, he Cusa, so that's about 1430, 1430, something like that. Cusa? Something like that, 14th century. Late 14th or early 15th century. And he is a diplomat, and he's a incredible church father and so forth, but he, 1440. So he is in a certain sense going against Aquinas, which was the last time that we had the reason, you know, Aquinas is kind of, how do you get to knowledge of God, let's say, in mystical terms. And Aquinas is kind of saying, you know, if you can catalog everything, all of God's creation, to a book on fishes, a book on ethics, a book on poetics, a book on invertebrates, a book on, you know, if you can do catalog everything, you will get to a better knowledge of God through that kind of thing. And Cusa's response, exactly to the degree that Aquinas came out of Aristotle, Cusa is known as a Neoplatonist. And he at one point says, and that can't be right. He says, imagine a circle with an n-sided regular polygonic side of it. By the way, he said, this is in a book called Learned Ignorance. Anyway, so you start with a triangle, and then you add a side of a square, and then you add a side of a pentagon, and you add more and more sides. You would think that if you had a million sides, you'd be close to the circle. And he says, but in fact, you're farther than you've ever been. The circle has one line, you've got a billion lines. This thing is all these angles and so forth. At some point, he says, you have to make the leap, and this is where I would come in with terror, the vertiginous sense of what that is. You have to make a leap of faith, as he calls it, which is where Kierkegaard gets it, from the cord to the arc. And that is going to be as difficult with a million sides as it is with three sides and so forth. And it is a qualitative difference. And it does seem to me that what I find the terrain of wonder, and he, by the way, he also says that that can only be accomplished in grace. Oh, we have an illustration. Can you share the illustration?
I have an illustration of the
book. No, I want to see it. Be careful what you say to this lady. Go ahead, come on.
So there's the most passive leap of faith.
precisely at that vertiginous limit, at the edge of Seidman College, for example. And when you go to, another way of putting what you just said, where if you could explain what you mean, I got that interested, that's the 15 sided polygon, it's all that's been your view for the circle.
I was in Toronto in the spring doing a senior thesis. I was an external reviewer and senior thesis for painting students, grad students at the Ontario College of Art and Design. And I walk into this room, they have a really interesting stuff the way they do it, but whatever, there's this senior this MFA guy who's does thesis exhibition. And I walk into the room and there's like 9 paintings and I just look at them and it's like, wow, this guy, I mean, yeah, the paint, the images, just, you know, the people in this room are, you're here for a reason, we're self-selected, right? So many of us spend a huge amount of time looking at images or thinking about art and you just sort of see it right away and then you have to stop and think, why does this all seem to make so much sense right away? The guy isn't pulling the work. I just feel it. You just feel it in the room. And then there was this one painting. There was at the very end of this, and it just sat there like a sore thumb. There was a bit of text that he had put into the gesso. And I walk over and I take the painting off the wall and I say, I hope you don't mind, but I'm just going to take this out for 1 second. Which, it was a kind of, don't get me wrong, it was a kind of situation where it was okay to do that, right? But he said, well, like a match. But I said, do you mind if we just move the, if we move this? The whole point was that there was supposed to be this crate. It wasn't like it was an installed exhibition. Okay? It was like, it was a crate. Right? And he went, no. And he had like this huge breath. And I said, what? And he said, thank you. What do you mean? He said, well, I think it looks better this way too. And so I said, well, I don't start with like looking better, but I'm trying to understand what's going on here. Make a long story short, that piece, that one of those 9 paintings, I said to him, is this painting here so that I will know, or we will know, that you know all the things you're supposed to know about painting right now? And he said, yeah. And I said, fuck it, we don't need more people in the world who are able to show us that they went to all the seminars. We need you to paint your painting. And that'll have traction or it won't, but you can't do anything more than that. Otherwise, you're just wasting our time. And that sounds sort of corny and romantic, but I actually mean it in a pretty, just in terms of how I work in the art world, it's a really important bit of efficiency from my point of view. I actually mean it in a really clinical way. It's like,
oh, absolutely.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, the director of Masumoto was getting ready to write his forward for the book, he said, what do you want me to write about? And I said, I want you to write about the fact that we're a museum that gives people the permission to get lost, that we don't have didactics next to everything. We're not about telling you, we're about letting you have an experience. And it's that same thing, like, you know, I get so dismayed at some museums because they're just like, they're trying to craft everything in such a specific way, or you go to an artist studio who's trying to tell you that they know, but really, it's much more interesting to not.
We were talking just before we started about the fact that if you read the catalog, and you will because you're all going to buy one, that each artist was asked a series of questions, and one of the questions that Denise asked each artist was, you know, to relay some moment of wonder that they had, the most recent one. And I was thinking on the drive down here from Connecticut, I can't really remember the most recent one, but what kept coming back in from my memory was the most profound one having to do with art. In Paris, went to the Pompidou, it was like on a Wednesday or something at 10:30 in the morning in February. The place was basically empty. I'm up on the 5th floor or 6th floor, I can't remember which, all the Braque. And it wasn't even very well lit. It was very dingy, sort of dark and dingy, and almost nobody there. And I just start hearing these sounds of, I can't describe it, but these like human moans and weeping. And I think it must be some kind of an installation or something, whatever. And as I turn the corner, I realize that there is a group of adults doing a little tour, but it's a group of people with Down syndrome. And I'm just hearing these guttural, can't even say what it is, but these guttural sounds as they're looking at these things, these oohs and these ahs. And I don't want to romanticize that per se and make something of that that it's not for me to make. It's disrespectful for me to do that, except to be able to say what my feeling, what my experience was, which was that I was in the presence of something, and yeah, I went to divinity school, I'm not saying it's God or anything, but whatever, you're in the presence of something else happening, and you get to witness that a little bit, and I just thought this is one of the most primary art experiences I'm likely to ever have.
It's so strange. I had exactly the same experience at the temporary in LA. And what happened was that it was the first series of Richard Serra's short clips, you know, and also some of the corridors that came in and came out and so forth. And I had to go to the airport, so I did that early. I was there at 10:30, just walking around. Yeah, that was interesting. Okay, that was all very nice. And then at a certain point, at around 10:45, the museum opened at 11, this school bus pulled up. And you could see that it was all glass, so you could see it. And out of it tumbled this Bruegelian mass of school kids.
Children, I hope so.
It wasn't children. I'm trying to not say, damaged children, but I mean, they were variously, some of them had football helmets on, some of them were blind, some of them were, it was clearly a school, a special needs school or whatever you want to call it, but they just kind of tumbled out of that bus, and then they came in, and they were all blind, that was sure, and they were had all been given percussive tambourines sticks, with mallets and so forth, and they kind of tumbled into the thing. And suddenly, there was this incredible excitement of this experience of space by these kids. And there was one in particular. I mean, so you heard all this banging, and they were clearly getting it. It was just the most amazing experience of those pieces. And one in part, and there kept on being this gong, and I was trying to figure out where that came from. And I came around, and you went into one of them, and there was one of those, you had to roll around, and then you got into the middle of the area, and this kid was with his football helmet. He was a headbanger. He was having headbanger heaven. He was a big gong. Well, it was just stunning. It was amazing. Because, by the way, that was a plate where it wasn't perpendicular. It was that, so he was. He had never had that experience before, and it was just, and I don't know, it looks better.
I'm sure it feels better. But it's interesting thinking about both of those stories and how often wonder gets aligned with childhood. Is this like these moments of experiencing and learning things for the first time? But I also think about how we can get back to that as adults, and is that witnessing something like that, or is it how do we continue to find that, which is I think something that often gets asked of wonder.
I think somebody will correct me, please do, if I get this wrong. And the Buddha said we're all born enlightened. We then spend a period of time where we become attached to things and realize that those things don't give us what we want, and what you really need to do is return to the childlike state of just directly present for it. I think that sense of direct experience is where, I think it's where many artists try to get as well, the terror of mark making at the beginning of the piece, and where is it going to go?
I think Brent has a poem for the occasion. but also I think, it's interesting, again, when you're a kid these things are happening to you for the first time. But, you know, the title of the show, Explode Every Day, comes from this amazing Ray Bradbury quote, who says, you know, to remain invested in your inner child, you need to learn to explode every day. You don't worry about the future, you don't worry about the past, you just explode. So it's like, as adults, we need to be more conscious of letting ourselves, letting go, in being able to have those kinds of experiences.
The poem I was going to read, there's a terrific poem by Thomas Tranströmer, a great Swedish poet. I'm going to read the whole poem. It's called Sentry Duty, or Guard Duty. And apparently in Sweden in the old days, everybody had to serve a year, all males had to serve a year in the Swedish army to protect against invasions from Norway, so I'm not sure what it was. But he's recalling being on all my guard duty when I was in the army. I ordered out to a big hump of stones as if I were an aristocratic corpse from the Iron Age. The rest are still back in the tent, sleeping, stretched out like spokes at a wheel. In the tent, the stove is boss. It's a big snake that swallows a ball of fire and hisses. But it's silent out here in the spring night among the chill stones, waiting for the dawn. Out here in the cold, I start to fly like a shaman straight after her money. Some place is pale from her swimsuit. The sun shone bright on us. I brush along the side of warm moments, but I can't stay there long. I whistle back through space, I crawl among the stones, back to here and now. Task, to be where I am. Even in this solemn and absurd role, I am still the place where creation does no work on itself. Tasked to be where I am. Even in this solemn and absurd role, I'm still the place where creation does a little work on itself. Dawn comes, the sparse tree trunks take on color now, frostbitten forest flowers form a silent search party after something that has disappeared in the dark. But to be where I am and to wait. I'm full of anxiety, obstinate, confused. Things not yet happened are already here. I feel that. They're just out there, a murmuring mass just outside the barrier. They can only slip in one by one. They want to slip in. Why? They do, one by one. I am the turnstile.
But you didn't read one of my favorites, which is The Spirit Level. I think we should end with that before we take some questions from the crowd.
Well, this is pretty, you know, it's like tossing stones. We're going to one Nobel Prize winner tonight. And maybe you can help us out with Bob Dylan. But I'll give you Seamus Heaney now. This is the last poem in a book that's called The Spirit Level. Spirit Level, of course, is that thing a carpenter uses, a little bubble on a curved thing to make sure that you get perpendicular. You can use spirit levels on that.
Hold the time. Although Massimo
Doyle is so crooked,
it doesn't
really matter. But this is a postscript book. Yeah, this is just Heaney talking about it begins. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones, the surface of a slate-gray lake is lit by the earthen lightning of a flock of swans. Their feathers rough and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think that you can park and capture it more thoroughly. You're neither here nor there. A hurry through which known and strange things pass as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open. Useless to think that you can park and capture it rather early. He's saying the opposite. He's saying you are neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's say, coming back to the here and now. You know,
yeah.
But,
well, I think,
and it also reminds me of the Great Sale Online. You know, you have to hurry up because see, everything is fast disappearing.
And I think that's the thing about wonder. It's neither here nor there, and it's in the here and now.
Go figure.
I'll build that out of something else.
I think we'll open it up to some questions. Anybody else? No? Okay. Let's open it up to some questions from the crowd. And I know we have, I think, two of the artists from the show in the audience, Charles Lindsay and Nina Cacciadorian. So they've answered all the questions that are in the book already. but yeah, questions?
Or just responses?
Or comments or anything?
Accusations.
Yeah.
I'm curious, this point that Lawrence brought up earlier about sort of the high art of wondercomer and how as there became more cultural sort of focus on this, it sort of ruined wonder. I guess I'm kind of curious to hear either of you, or any of you, expand on that relationship between scarcity and wonder, I guess.
That's interesting. There's a book called Wonder, the Rainbow, and the Aesthetics of Rare Experiences by Philip Fisher. And when I was preparing for this show, I read that book, and the whole time I was reading it, I kept saying, no, 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 because he kept insisting that wonder had to be a rare experience. It had to be something that hit you all at once wholly, or else it wasn't considered wonder. Yet the example he uses, and yeah, I did wear this sweater on purpose, is the rainbow. And the rainbow is something we continue to see our whole lives, and yet knowing it, we can still find wonder in it.
But because so, then we don't will it, we don't go looking for it, it's impossible, we don't go looking for it.
Right, but it's not rare.
No, it's not rare, but it's not something that you can.
It comes out the heart sideways and blows it open.
But I don't, you know, but because of that, I don't think it can just be about scarcity. And I think because of that, it can't just be about the rare. I think there is something to eyes wide open to the world, too. You know, again, it sounds like a little hokey to think of, like, you have to just be open to your surroundings, but I think there is a sense of being able to find wonder.
But that wasn't exactly your question, I don't think, right? I mean, I think, I don't know if I'm wrong, I think what you're trying to say is the more stuff people collected and the more wonder comment there were, the less meaningful it was. And to me, that's how I feel about the moment we're living in right now. The amount of data and information means that there's virtually no data and no information. Because it's simply impossible to synthesize it. But that might just be me. But I feel like this is very much, I hope this is very much a high point, and we don't go any higher with this just bombardment of data.
One of the things that's in my book about the Museum of Address Technology, I talk about the pre-modern roots of the postmodern. That to the extent that the postmodern is a allergic reaction to all the data. Mm-hmm. So it is, when you go to the Museum of Jurassic Technology, at first you think it's a wonderful postmodern farce, you know, question authority and so on, but you realize that he is in fact, and Thomas McKelvey did a fantastic essay on this, about the way in which it's a little bit like the old joke about grandparents and grandchildren, why they like each other so much. Common enemies. and that coming out of the age of size, age of data, you have this taste for slippage, for retentiveness and so forth.
Yeah, I guess just thinking about what you had said earlier about data, and I feel like data is not experiential, it's not an experience. And really what I feel like is being talked about is this idea of being present. And it's the problem you've articulated with the sort of contemporary art scene, as it were, where there's discourse is privileged, data is privileged over an experience. And the expectation is that the privileged position is something that you can quantify. And that's one of the real challenges, I think, of the space that you're talking about, the space of wonder. I wonder with your, what?
I just said where I
want
to
go. You said I love this one.
Let's finish. I mean, I'm ready to go. He's licking his chops.
And so I wonder with this project, like, what were the sort of spaces of loss? Because I feel like that's something that's really important is loss. And we get lost all the time. And, you know, the same thing, like, there's wonder around us all the time. It didn't go anywhere. That's your question of be present with. So I wonder what was the lost part?
We're going to blow up here. I don't remember the first thing you said, but like after, anyway. I grew up Roman Catholic, Irish Roman Catholic. Really fucking Irish Catholic. But it's, so 364 days a year, the church that we would go to had statues and paintings and candles and all that stuff. It was one day out of the year where all the statues would be covered. If you're Catholic, you know where I'm going. Where all the statues would be covered in purple fabric. The cross would be covered. The tabernacle would be open. Where the host, usually the consecrated host, usually would sit, would be not there. And that would be Saturday between Good Friday and Sunday, Resurrection. I ended up being haunted by that as I went through graduate school, that in Catholicism, liturgically speaking, this moment of complete emptiness was one of the most powerful moments for me personally, and the center of it was complete absence. So, if you're not Catholic, Jesus is crucified on Friday. He's died, buried that day. And the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed says, then he descended into hell. So in other words, he's dead. We're without God. There's one whole day every year where we are, liturgically, symbolically, there is no God. And that's the day of complete silence, where there's no visual stimulation. And by canon law, the playing of the organ is not allowed. And the music that you'll hear if you go to a traditional church on that day, if you hear any, will have no harmony. It's just, it's flat. But for me, that always was one of the most powerful moments of the entire year, when God's not there. Almost like a vacuum kind of pulling me in. And then I'll leave it at this. The other last little bit about that liturgy is that the priest would, at one point, prostrate himself before the altar, lie flat on the ground in front of this empty tabernacle. So the greatest reverence for Catholics comes in the moment of Christ's death and, more importantly, Christ's symbolic complete absence from the world.
Just one quick thing, very quickly. Today, some of you may be listening to this U360 day broadcast, I think, which blew my mind, which is Lincoln. Was killed on Good Friday. Well, he was shot on Good Friday, died on that Saturday. And
I think he was a Methodist, wasn't he?
in terms of
my story.
In terms of a secular guy.
But I also think that idea of loss, I think it's one of the things that makes wonder the emotion it is, because it's often such a fleeting thing, and it's often something we try to like grasp and hang on to, but we have to let go of, and it is inherently about those lost moments, and so I think that's, you know,
you say we are at a loss.
Yeah, exactly.
We are at a loss.
Or you say lost for words.
Yep.
Or I was breathless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charlie.
I have a couple points. It's not a concise question, but something I've been thinking about is art as an evolutionary driver, not just as a record of it. And I was thinking about these periods in late 20th century, and it continues now, where art hasn't been interesting to children. Most children, I have friends that are famous artists.
It's not general.
No, not general. Aspects of it. Even friends' kids, their parents are famous artists and
kids
are.
Kids don't love minimalism.
Yeah, or it's a lot of the pop, you know, a lot of the economic stuff. And I was just thinking, like, you know, what culture is making art that it's children you know, its future or not interested. Hopefully, I mean, now there's so much of everything that there's something for everything.
It's also value. It's also almost a value. Like, if your work is, like, appreciated by chickens, it might be kind of a problem.
Well, the embarrassment thing.
There's a very famous artist that my daughter adores his work. And this is a guy I know. And every time I see him, I think, oh, I want to tell you how much my daughter adores your work. She's 12. But he'd kill me. But it really means something to me. It does. It actually, that there is a connection there. And that's like, I don't know, we should start talking about like post-embarrassment.
But your daughter's also the person who wrote the part of the E coming on the wall in your house, right?
Yes.
I love, like, when my niece and nephew came to visit, were 10 and 14, I loved seeing what they responded to. You know, it's always so interesting to me the things that they pick up on.
That artist, by the way, you know him, the work of the...
I do. He's a good friend. I've shown his work. But if I relayed the story, he would just...
Because it wouldn't be serious work.
Well, you know, okay. You know what? I'll be honest.
Just be honest.
No, no, no. I'm not going to name the artist. What I am going to say is that the issue is mine. The issue is mine, right?
Yep.
Like, I don't want to... If he doesn't get how amazing that is to me to have a proud dad, it gets weird.
The issue isn't so, yours, the issue is the art world's.
Maybe.
You know,
post-embarrassment art, you heard it here, folks.
Well, because you're afraid to tell him that because you think that he won't think he's perceived the proper way. And that's more than...
Well, artists are tired of hearing, I think many artists do, sort of get tired. Many artists get tired of hearing about, you know, people's kids and their work. And so you have to have, there's got to be a signal over.
Me too.
You know? He said, I don't.
No, I'll just throw this in. Every exhibition I've had, maybe 100 or something, I always have something deliberately hung for children. Like sometimes 2 feet off the ground or 3 feet.
I was curator in a nonprofit space in Hartford for 6 or 7 years, and the director up there insisted on there being a family month. February family month, and so everything had to be family oriented. And I ended up sort of quitting, sort of getting fired, because in the last 2 years I was there, I just simply programmed what I was going to program anyway, and I hung it at 32 inches.
Which I think that's, you know...
Exactly.
You should program what you're going to program. Like, you don't need to pander to children. I think it's much more interesting if they're responding to the same things that adults are responding to.
They're just people.
They're just smaller people.
I was going to say, I think also that we need to, as you said before, continue to have the sense of wonder that we have as children when we're adults, when we approach art or when we approach the world. I was reminded of, by the talk, an article a few months ago in the Times where in the art section they interviewed people who were at the new Met Broyer, asked them to respond to the art they were seeing there in the show that was the partially unfinished works. And all the people who were interviewed talked about either what they thought they were seeing in the art or what they thought the artist might have been trying to show them in the art. But none of them talked about their emotion about the art or their sense of wonder in the art. They felt that they needed to respond, or they'd been taught to respond in a factual, data-driven way. And it was so shocking to me because I'm not really a person who's of the art world. I'm very much interested in art, and I love to look at art, but my response to art is always the emotional one. And it's not something I had as a child. I had very little sense of wonder in my childhood. Not for any reason, just because my parents were very serious. So I cultivated my sense of wonder as an adult, and I've cultivated my interest in art as an adult. And I'm, like you said, looking for wonder every day.
Well,
I don't want it to be rare. I want it to be every day.
My guess is because you weren't sort of formed in the art world, that you're able to access it free of things that we're supposed to bring to it. So I think now I remember what I was going to reply to your question earlier.
which is, so I worked in nonprofits for a while. I was an artist myself a long, long time ago. That didn't go so well, which is now why I do this. But I remember, so I now work for a private collector, and I remember, it's clear as it was yesterday, I operate a collection from Connecticut, but the collector I work for lives here in New York. And a JPEG came through, this is about 3 weeks after starting to work with him, a JPEG came through, and I went, oh, okay, and I'll look at that later. And then the phone rang, and the guy I work for, McKee Hardin, says, hey, did you see that piece I just sent you? I went, yeah. And he says, what do you think? And in my brain, what I started doing, I'm a curator, et cetera, is, okay, would I show this piece? If I showed this piece, is this, what does this piece mean in the context of this artist's body of work? Having worked in a nonprofit and written grants and had to deal with directors and trustees, why am I saying this is the work that we would want to see versus somebody else's? Are they emerging? Are they there yet? What would be the point of doing this exhibition? And I hear Mickey say, did you hear me? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, what do you think? I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, like, what do you think? I said, I don't know. I just really love it. He said, great. I do too. Let's buy it. Okay. That, to me, was this real, like, I can remember that like it was yesterday, because what mattered there was, you know, at that point in my life, I'd looked at a lot of images, I'd gone to art school, I'd curated exhibitions, I'd been to, you know, whatever. And then, out of the blue, comes the question, is this something that moves you enough that you would want to have it? And we talk about commerce as being a dirty word in the art world in some ways, etc. We're all tired of it. I'm very tired of money in the art world. But that notion of exchange, this is something I would want to possess for no other reason than to have it. That's a form of that cognition that I was talking about earlier. And it doesn't come from training. It just comes from somewhere else. The visceral.
So maybe you said you're tired of the money in the upper, but maybe that's more of a problem with the professionalization of the upper, because most museum collection was based on just like private collectors, right? Maybe it's like very more direct response.
The issue of money, just money's everything. You can't look at something as clearly as we once could 5 or 6 years ago. Or it just gets tedious and you just like stop and you go on to something.
It's kind of always been that way.
No, not like this.
I was listening to an art historian of the art market, and she was talking about the same exact situation at the beginning of the 20th century in France. And
but that's different than saying it's always been like that. I think,
no,
so I agree with
just
you.
Just like the money aspect on that. But what I'm saying is like your thinking about that piece and his thinking about that piece were very different. That the collector you're working with and your response.
The issue was that I was thinking about it and he wasn't asking me. He said, do you like it?
Yeah. No,
that's a very different question than whether I would program it, fund it, show it.
No, that's what I was addressing.
Yeah. I often think that any work of art is somewhere between priceless and worthless.
Yeah.
And anything else you can say about its monetary value in any given time is comedy.
That's Virginia Woolf. Saul Witt used to quote Virginia Woolf saying that all the time. Except the quote was, as he remembers it, rephrased it, is art is either priceless or worthless. What's in between? For him, it's either or the other.
And then there's this fascinating character named Cy Lewin that our Spiegel recently got onto. Just published a book, who was a successful artist in the 50s. He's a fascinating life story, and suddenly stopped showing because he felt that art could not be sold. It was priceless, and that it shouldn't have any price. And he just dropped out of the market completely. Everybody was dead. And it turned out he'd been working the entire time and was still alive when art found him and had been painting extravagantly amazing, amazing stuff. And furthermore, had a
certain point, realizing that art was priceless, he realized it was also worthless. And he had started cutting up his earlier canvases and making grids out of them that were just incredibly amazing to look at. It's a guy who and then, the, by the way, Art wrote this book about him. It's just kind of, okay, you look at it. But it was presented to him, and he died 2 days later. The stuff is still there. The stuff is there, and it's just amazing. But he was shown, and there's a video of him being shown the book.
Wow.
And he just died 2 days later. But he's been out of the art market for a total number of time, and he's a really good guy.
I think on that note, we'll continue this conversation casually. So thank you all for being here.